I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Kevin Middleton, and I'm here in the studio with Samantha Berg. Today, we're going to talk about individual and cultural transformation and evolution. We have entered an age of disruption and massive accelerating change with simultaneously converging challenges that no other generation has faced on this planet. Financial collapse, global population growth, climate change, dying oceans and deforestation, dwindling access to fresh, clean water, corrupted food supply, unprecedented global corporate and political corruption, and a steadily growing gap between the very wealthy and the very poor, to name just a few. At the same time, there are incredible opportunities and emerging technologies that can help us solve these challenges and leave a positive legacy for future generations. The question is, if we have the tools and the intellectual capacity, do we have the will, the strength, and the vision to actually make it happen? And how do we create a culture where these higher values and a higher sense of purpose and service make its way from the common person all the way up to the highest levels of governmental, political, technological, and financial power to take root and produce a sustainable, inspired future for us all? To look at these questions, our guest Amy Edelstein joins us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to help us gain insight into how individuals and cultures evolve.
So before we introduce Amy, I want to give you an introduction to her. So Amy is an innovative thinker in personal transformation and in the evolution of shared cultural values and how culture itself evolves. She is a teacher, public speaker, and writer committed to individual transformation that extends to large-scale cultural change. She is one of a handful of designated senior teachers of Andrew Cohen's Evolutionary Enlightenment, a path that connects individual transformation with a deep sense of responsibility for our collective future. Her passion is supporting individual development and envisioning and building the structures of culture that support higher values and perspectives. She works with individuals at all levels of experience, designing year-long programs for the exploration of evolutionary spirituality, as well as facilitating weekend and evening workshops in the U.S. and abroad. A Cornell University College scholar, Amy has a background in Judaic philosophy as well as Hindu and Buddhist thought. She studied with several preeminent Hindu and Buddhist teachers in the early 1980s in Asia before meeting Andrew Cohen. A passionate researcher and cultural commentator, Amy served for 5 years as a senior editor of the award-winning Enlightened Next magazine and is currently working on a project for university students, our next generation of leaders, about ethics, values, meaning, and purpose. She is the co-founder of Emergence Education and lives in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania with her husband. So welcome to the show, Amy. Great to have you here.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. We have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, we do. And maybe we could start off with a little bit of your background and maybe your own spiritual seeking years and how it's led you to the evolutionary spirituality and how that ties in with cultural evolution as well.
Sure. I'd be happy to tell you a little bit about myself and my journey. Just to say a little bit before that, in response to the intro that you laid out, because I live in Philadelphia, so when I go out for morning coffee, I walk the streets, and I live about 5 blocks from where they worked on the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. And I know at that time there were terrible problems. They had, horrible diseases. They had overpopulation in urban centers. There was no safety. There were always major urban fires. There was slavery. There was tyranny from colonization. So if you think about the times 300 years ago, 250 years ago, I think in that day and age also, individuals who were forward-looking were looking out at the culture around them and saying, oh, my God, how are we going to make it? It's looking pretty grim. Things are not very good, and we've got to change. So there's no denying that, particularly with our ecological challenges, that we're reaching a different rate of change and urgency of response. But I do think also that innovators were faced with similar challenges and with the sense that there was just a tremendous boulder to move uphill in order to change the cultural climate of the times. And they did it. And they were successful, and they envisioned a different order of being together, a different order of governance, a different order of civilization, and pushed us through a certain age and established a plateau and that culture has developed from, and we are at one of those turning points now. But I certainly feel that in the spirit of the revolutionaries who've come before us, we have a serious task ahead of us, but I by no means feel that it's more than what we're able to rise up to.
Well, that's really an inspiring context to lay out for the conversation. And it feels like this is a time when we have incredible capacity to connect on a large scale with other people, like-minded people, sharing passion and interest in making things better. And the world is ready for it.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting because as you're saying that we can connect with other people, when I was just thinking, like, you know, Ben Franklin, when he went to Europe, it took him 3 months to get there. And when I went to Asia in search of, I had been at Cornell University, as you mentioned, as Sam mentioned, and I always wanted to study with the best and brightest professors, the ones who'd really had life experience, had been with world leaders, and were teaching from a deep sense of their own passion for their subject matter. But I always felt that they didn't really have the deeper answers that I was looking for. They had knowledge, and many of them were very good people, but they didn't have deeper answers. And I went to Asia in search of those answers in the early 80s. So it was 1983 when I went to Asia. And at that time, there were no cell phones. There was no email. We had, you know, we could communicate by aerogram. So you'd write an aerogram, and if somebody didn't steal the stamp from it, maybe it would get back. And you get an answer back, you know, another 6 weeks later. If you happen to arrive at the general post office the right day and the right time, you know, and that aerogram didn't miss you. And it was, that time was a time of real, you could still go exploring. And I spent 12 months in the Himalayas just searching, looking for different teachers and spending time in the mountains where I felt that you could really contemplate and meditate. The vistas were unbelievable, as I'm sure they are in Alaska, and you could really think big up there. And I spent about 4 years in between Asia and the States doing a lot of spiritual practice and retreat and trying to meet every teacher I heard about who seemed to know something.
How did you go about finding different teachers? Because it seems like everyone seems to say, well, I've got the answer, I know. And how did you go about asking the different questions or finding people to point you in the right direction? Or did you just go and listen and make your own decision?
Well, there's word of mouth. And in those times, you'd meet in some tea shop somewhere and talk with, you know, other seekers or hippies about, you know, the word on the street, and you'd hear about some great lama that somebody met who's, you know, just arrived from Bhutan, who was the most enlightened one. You'd go check them out, or, you know, this Westerner who's been teaching retreats for 10 years in some other town, you go check them out. I mean, nowadays, you can search YouTube. You've got Lonely Planet guides, you've got spiritual guides. I recently led a retreat for 30 or 40 millennials, you know, students between the ages of 20 and 30, young adults. And we were talking about how to deal with the complexity of culture and a lot of the ways that Kevin was laying out. And I was also wanting them to grapple with the fact that there is such a thing as enlightenment and spiritual development. And one of the assignments before our two-day immersion was to choose videos of people who are said to be enlightened over the last, you know, 50, 60 years. I mean, went back to individuals, you know, 100 years ago where we had audio. And then we spent several hours looking at examples of awakened masters and listening to them and studying them What are they saying? What's their transmission? Why can you tell that some of these individuals seem to have a taste of the non-dual, a taste of the beyond, where others don't? And yet, that taste of the non-dual, or that radiance of the beyond, of something deeper, of some sense of consciousness absolute, a sense of a recognition of the infinite nature of consciousness, of being, could express itself so differently in so many different people. And once we started looking, you can come up with quite a big list and start checking them out. And I would encourage everybody to do that. Everyone who's really interested in deep spiritual transformation, personal transformation, and world transformation, I encourage everyone to really look for examples and see what they have and see why it's attractive and what are the limitations, what are the positive qualities of it. I always felt that it was important to look at the human expressions and look at look for teachers of all kinds, and teachers will be excel in different vertical, vertical areas of interest. You know, so you can have all kinds of teachers. You can have spiritual teachers. You can have business teachers. I encourage people to look for spiritual teachers and see. They don't have all the answers, but they certainly know something. And it when we see people with expressions of more depth than we have, more humanity, more empathy, it's attractive, and we resonate with that. We start vibrating at a higher frequency. So
you said it was expressed differently through different teachers. What would you say some of the other common threads are when you run up against an enlightened teacher, when you're listening to or you're watching a YouTube video? What is it for you that says, oh, this person is expressing something different? It's not just a psychological context.
There is, when individuals awaken to that spiritual stirring, that sense of the beyond, and most of us have had glimpses of it. People have had glimpses. Many people have experiences when they're young children or in their early teens of perfect joy, of this sense of a deep happiness and fullness welling up from within that's unbidden, uncalled for, uncaused. It just seems to come from nowhere, a sense of joy, stillness, positivity, empathy, a sense of being awake and a sense of being at home in oneself, a sense of no separation, no division. And we've all had some little glimpses of it, but usually not recognized, and some people have more profound senses of that and do recognize that. And when you see an awakened master, that's a foundation for their being that they don't move from. And so what you experience when you're with them is you experience a person who has an extraordinary both lightness of being, a sense of freedom from the pressures of the world, and at the same time a sense of profound attentiveness. That it's almost like they're deeply at rest and deeply listening without making any effort at the same time. I mean, everyone loves the Dalai Lama. Not everyone agrees with his politics. Not everyone agrees with his philosophy. Not everyone agrees with his practice or his science. But everyone loves him, and they love him because he exudes a lightness of being that fills you with a sense of positivity and joy, quiet joy. And that's that radiance. It's a spiritual radiance. And that radiance can make it possible to do all kinds of things, and to bridge all kinds of divides that you wouldn't expect.
Absolutely. You can just look at his radiant smile and be disarmed in a way. I saw him at Cornell University my last year there, and it was incredible, just his presence and how he took seemingly very complex questions and reduced them to the most simple and beautiful answer through this joyous radiance. It was very striking to me at the time. So the question I want to ask is, how does this tie in? So this profound discovery of wholeness, this unifying truth that lies at the heart of the human existence, of all of reality, this discovery then has cultural relevance. And I want to talk a little bit about that and what that discovery was for you and how you found this to answer the questions that you didn't find answered at the university.
It's interesting for me. I think that's probably in some ways answers that I found one half at one point in my life and then another half probably 10 years later. And I had powerful spiritual experiences when I was younger. And so I did have that direct sense of an unbroken field of consciousness. It just seemed factual to me, not airy-fairy or mystical. I had had a glimpse of it, and it just seemed like the way things were underneath everything else. And then I searched for that and experienced all the kinds of angst and sense of alienation that most of us feel somewhere in our being. And at one point when I came in contact with Andrew Cohen, who's a contemporary American spiritual teacher who had started teaching in 1986, he knew a powerfully awakened non-dual Vedanta teacher, Indian teacher, and he had had his own awakening experience with that. And when he was one of those people, when I met him, I knew that he knew about this dimension of self, this unbroken dimension of consciousness. And I spent some time with him in 1986, and after several weeks of discussion and talking, I had a very profound experience of the only thing I can call it is non-dual awareness, where nothing particular happened, but all of a sudden it felt like a veil between me and the world just fell away. And on one hand, nothing changed. I was the same person. I had the same history. I had the same fears and the same desires. But on the other hand, none of that mattered in a deeper way. And I knew without a doubt that there was a part of the self that the Buddhists call the unborn or the deathless, and the Hindus call Brahman consciousness or Atman, and you know, in Judaism and in mystical Christianity and in Islam, they all have different terminology for this, but it's a sense of that field of God awareness or consciousness that is full in and of itself. And it was so powerful. That experience stayed with me for several weeks. And from that point on, I knew that I didn't need to look for that anymore. I knew without a doubt that that was something that was a part of reality, and that I could align my life to that. I didn't need to have kind of a constant reaffirmation of that type of spiritual experience. So it didn't mean I didn't struggle after that. I certainly did, and I did a lot of spiritual practice after that. And Andrew Cohen founded a whole teaching called Evolutionary Enlightenment. His teaching developed into an evolutionary teaching mostly when he discovered the work of a cultural developmental theorist named Don Beck, and who works with a system called spiral dynamics, and the cosmological philosopher Brian Swim, who talks about our deep time, about the 13.7 billion year history of the universe. And when Andrew Cohen came in touch with those two individuals, who were beautiful individuals with a beautiful vision, I was working with Andrew Cohen on his magazine, Enlightened Next magazine. And so the whole editorial team spent many, many hours studying both this work of cultural development, the work of deep time history. And it really profoundly changed the way Andrew Cohen contextualized spiritual life. And it was that point where I really started to think about my own development within this 13.7 billion year context. And as I started to do that, and the, you know, after 5-6 years of really contemplating that in my own inquiry and all the research that I was doing and the articles that I was writing were related to that, it really, my whole focus shifted, and I recognized that the stuff of evolution is us, that I'm not a separate individual with my own limitations or neurotic problems that need to get sorted out, but that those issues and knots and cultural limitations of my cultural habits are all part of the stuff of evolution. It's both evolution at the level of consciousness and our capacities for self-reflection, and it's also evolution of the shared values between us. And when you recognize that your own process is the stuff of a deeper change, then the relationship to personal transformation immediately shifts. So if you have a particular habit, if you're fearful about this or insecure about that or over-assess your own capacities in this way, it no longer is a personal issue. You start to see it as the result and product of deeply ingrained habits that come from 50,000 years of human history, you know, societal history, and that's a long time and many stages. And, you know, they're also the result of our evolutionary past, of reactions and responses from our reptilian brain. We're so deeply habituated by our biology and all, by our surroundings and by cultural history. When you start to see that, and you start to engage with that and become an archaeologist of yourself, everything becomes fascinating, and everything becomes raw material for evolution. And then the whole process of development becomes, you know, an unbroken reaching towards higher levels of understanding and ability to hold complexity, and also higher levels of integration of knowledge, integration of these different levels of ourselves.
There's a few things about what you said that I want to go back to for the sake of our audience. One of the things was that you said that it sounds like the waking up process for you was the starting point. It wasn't for you, it wasn't something that you had the experience and you knew you didn't have to go looking for it. Is there anything you could say that was different for you as opposed to the person who has some kind of enlightenment experience and then goes seeking for that enlightenment experience for 20 years? Because the way you're describing it, that was the beginning point. It was an opening that allowed you to search for depth in all these other areas. And it kind of, you moved on. It's like that was the starting place. It wasn't something that, well, now I have to go and have this experience over and over again. Is there any reason you think that was different for you?
I think partly it had to do with my own frame of reference, and also the frame of reference of Andrew Cohen, because what I was looking for was, I was always looking for, how do we create better culture? I have I lived in Israel in 1970 and then again in 1979 for a year each time. And in that country, they've done a lot of socialist experiments. I'm not a particular advocate of socialism, but when you have a young country that was founded in 1948 and it's beginning to be populated, you can experiment with all kinds of communal structures. So I was always interested in how you do that. So after one has a certain kind of awakening, if you're motivated by creating a better life on Earth for everyone, then you just want to see, how are you going to apply this? How are you going to put this into practice? What does it mean for people living together? What are the cultural structures that you can create in the town or village or community that you live in, or among your friends or your family or with your spouse, that's going to better express that? So that was always my bent. And then evolutionary enlightenment was really founded on a collective awakening, and the sense that spiritual realization is the beginning point. And then we can get about with the stuff of creating a culture that's founded on a more awakened foundation, which is much better than a less awakened foundation. So for people who tend to continue to seek for spiritual experience, probably in some sense are not recognizing the significance of the experience they've already had. So they don't know what to do with it. If you have an experience and you know it's really powerful, but you also need to know what to do with it. You need to know what to do next. You need to know, well, what's the next step? We know how to seek, but what happens once we find? And I do feel more and more people are much more interested in what do we do after we find than perhaps in the 80s. I think it's a cultural shift as well.
So can you make some distinctions? What you really took a non-traditional spiritual path, and how do we see this in light of traditional religious structures? People are in many ways finding it harder and harder to relate to the mythic structures of organized or traditional religious ideology, and what you're describing is a very empowered, self-propelled spiritual discovery. I'm wondering if you have anything to say about that.
I've always been interested in classical religion, and you know, in Judaism, Christianity. I know much less about Islam, but I know some about Buddhism and some about Hinduism. I've always found tremendous value looking at that source material. And again, I encourage people. It's inspiring, and what's lasted throughout the ages really does come from deeply awakened mystics, and it can encourage us to look and to seek for depth, and it can also fill us with a kind of sense of spiritual support, even reading people who have long since moved on from this world. So I don't feel the need to reject the religious traditions. At the same time, any philosophical system is part and parcel of the culture from which it arises in. Evolutionary enlightenment is part and parcel of postmodern culture. It was, articulated by an individual who was born into a postmodern culture, that the individuals working with it are postmodern, the new teachers like myself out of it are postmodern. So in 200 years, they're going to look back and say, well, that's filled with all kinds of limitation and biases from that particular space and time. It has awakened understanding, it has vision, and it also has limitations, just like Plato and Socrates and Aristotle had limitations from their time. And, the great Vedantists did too, and the Desert Fathers did. So we want to read all of those with an understanding of the cultural climate in which they arose out of, and recognize that anything that we're doing now is going to be infused with the cultural climate of our times. So I feel that part of the understanding new definitions of a spirituality that is more useful for our contemporary world comes out of this recognition that culture and philosophy and our individual selves you can't separate those out. You can never have a pure mysticism disembedded from culture, from the culture it arises from.
That's great, Amy. We're going to take a brief break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Amy Edelstein. We're speaking about individual and collective spiritual transformation and cultural evolution. We'll be right back.
You are listening to KVRF FM, Big Cabbage Radio. We are an all-volunteer station. New volunteers are welcome. Email us at manager@radiofreepalmer.org or call 745-8951.
Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and we are speaking with Amy Edelstein. And I wanted to go back to one of the things we were just talking about before the break was the fact that we are a postmodern culture. And for those people who don't may not have heard that term before, could you define for us, Amy, what it means to be living in a postmodern culture?
Sure. People argue about when postmodernity began. If you look at some of the biggest stages of history, you have traditional culture, which tends to refer to, if you look at early Judeo-Christian culture, and we went from a very tribal social structure to a culture that had universal value sets. The Ten Commandments were a universal value set, and it applied universal laws and a judicial system over a culture. And that was a huge, huge innovation. I mean, it was the wild Middle East in the early biblical days. I would definitely not want to go back to those times. That would be traditional culture lasted quite a long time. And of course, the roots of that are still in us. And then you look at modernity, which came about when there was increasing urbanization and industrialization, which allowed the value structure to shift. And it shifted, you can see, in the early urban cultures in 16th, 17th, 18th century in Europe. And postmodernity, some argue started with the French Revolution, some argue that it started with the American transcendental philosophers like Emerson and Thoreau, and some argue that it really started with the 60s, the 1960s, and the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. So I would see it over the last several hundred years, but the way to think about, well, what are the postmodern values, it's easy to look at the values of the 1960s. And what we saw then was a movement towards greater inclusivity. So there was a greater sense of compassion for people around the world. We cared about the Bangladeshi suffering from hunger. We cared about the environment. We had the whole environmental movement. We cared about gender relationships between men and women and the equalization of rights and freedoms and respect across genders. Those were very much postmodern values. It was the sense of individual freedoms, individual rights, diversity, inclusivity. And that really led to a lot of what we have in our culture now. It led to a sense that I am important. I'm not just doing my duty for God and country. I'm not just putting my individual desires and talents aside because of duty and roles and restricted structures, but I can find my own talents, my own potential. And so that very much defines postmodern culture. Now, there are downsides of postmodern culture. One of the downsides is too much focus on the individual. And what that's led to is a lot of the popular books have talked about is the me generation, the culture of narcissism, the refusal to be disciplined, the sense that the entitlement, being spoiled, not having a sense of value, refusing authority, rebelling against authority, lack of direction. So there's a lot of pathology to the postmodern era. At the same time, it was a massive leap forward culturally, and it's led to a lot of positive responses across the world to try to help uplift culture. I mean, even if you look right now at the movement of these what they call massive open online courses, the goals of those, their three major companies doing that, their goal is a real postmodern goal. They want to make very high-quality higher education available for free online to anyone who wants it around the world. So in modernity, there wouldn't have been that sense of equality or that sense of connectedness around the globe. There just wouldn't have been. It just wasn't one of the values. People couldn't see that yet. So that would be a thumbnail of what the values of postmodernity are like, and a little bit of the sense of the negative of postmodernity. And obviously, we're all postmodern. We're born into this period of time, and so we're learning how to work with those values and also direct ourselves beyond them. So with the lack of hierarchy, we need to start imposing a hierarchy of values.
Amy, as we're talking about cultural evolution, can you say a little bit more about the engine of that evolution itself? Is it that the limitation of a cultural structure then creates a tension, a sort of friction that gives rise to the next leap forward? And do you feel that can we take the leap forward, the next leap forward, without a deep, profound awakening to a unifying truth we were speaking about earlier in spiritual freedom, spiritual liberation?
It's a very good question, and in all truthfulness, I don't know if we need to awaken to it or not. I certainly would advocate awakening to that, which I can lay out for various reasons. But I've had the tremendous privilege and opportunity of meeting visionaries who are beautiful and have a real sense of the future and care deeply. And visionaries are motivated by all kinds of things. So is it essential to awaken to this? I don't know that it's essential. I wouldn't want to say that. At the same time, of course, that's been my path, and I certainly would encourage people to look in this direction. And what you're asking about are the two aspects of what could be called an absolute or unified or non-dual expression. And one is what I referred to before, is that sense of consciousness itself, of awareness and emptiness, fullness, the nature of being. And the other is the presence of that forward-reaching drive of evolution that seems to have propelled the universe from, you know, early forms of matter, all condensed and crunched up in some unbelievably compact little bit that seems to, however science wants to interpret it, and I'm not a physicist or a high-level mathematician, so I don't know how accurate all the different theories are, but you just metaphorically even imagine that incredibly dense, earliest form of matter and energy exploding out, and then over 13.7 billion years somehow mysteriously creating these ever-increasing complex forms of life, from the way atoms cohered, electrons cohered to help form atoms cohered to form compounds cohered, you know, and on and on and on, until we get human beings with, you know, we have these bodies that cohere together, but the stuff of our bodies is no different than the stuff of those tiny little particles that make up all of matter and life. So it's so fascinating that we can awaken to that impulse of life and development, that impulse of evolution that courses through everything and that seems to be directing life towards ever-increasing complexity. And as we awaken to that impulse of evolution and creativity, we awaken to a source of energy that's way beyond ourselves. And when we awaken to that source of energy that's way beyond ourselves, it can catalyze in us an incredible optimism and lightness of being that we spoke about with the Dalai Lama, that sense of lightness of being in the face of the world's hardships. And that lightness of being can help us find solutions and come together with people in extraordinary ways.
Now, in your work with individuals and organizations, do you find that that people are able to connect with this? Is this really a message that's arrived and people are really ready to hear it? I know most people think about evolution in terms of material or biological systems, but what you're talking about is an internal dimension of evolution as well.
I think people can, and I do feel that it's something that's emergent in culture. I think there have been a few really key individuals who've helped bring this into culture, and now there are many more people. I mean, it's still a handful, but there are many more people who are speaking about it. We're having this program about it. It's not that unusual to have a program about it like this. And so I feel that within the fabric of culture, different than 20 years ago, there is a recognition of the evolutionary impulse in life, and that being a source of tremendous potential, and that we can awaken to it, we can come together with that as part of our shared context, and that can help create a kind of unity of purpose in very, very unusual ways. And I do feel that, I mean, obviously, if you take the billions of people in the world and you look at the level of subsistence that far, far too many people are living at, of course, they don't really have the luxury to awaken to evolution. Those billions of people are dealing with horrific conditions that we desperately need to alleviate. But for those people who have the tremendously good karma and privilege to be born into a life of relative education and affluence, I feel this awakening is to evolution and to the potential of evolution is something that's becoming increasingly part of the conversation.
That's great. You know, with the postmodern era, this capacity for higher individuation has given us an understanding of ourselves in a way that never really existed before. You know, our grandparents and those that came before wouldn't necessarily have the same answers to how are you feeling. You know, these are things that that really a depth of sensitivity to what it is to be a human being, and this greater capacity for inclusive thinking and that has emerged. And I almost sense, you know, I've got friends in Turkey who are putting pictures of the events that are happening right now there, and I feel so deeply connected to that. And there's almost like an energy that's building up in the global consciousness to really leap forward and make a change. And so this movement from being very individualized, but now there's this energy or this excitement to release that to a much bigger perspective for the sake of the whole. And it does seem like it's happening on a large scale, and technologies like Facebook and social media are really making that happen on a bigger scale. Any thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is it's both the technology is changing us, and we are changing the technology. The fact of Facebook and Twitter and the types of communication we have are literally changing our global landscape. And the younger generation, the individuals in their 20s now, they grew up with the Arab Spring. They grew up with the sense that huge cultural revolution could take place in this very dispersed way. Just a groundswell of focus and consciousness from tweet to tweet to tweet. And the next thing you know is that from a very restrictive culture, you know, you have a revolution that's able to create social change. Now, of course, building the structures that stabilize that social change is massive, and whether these revolutions are going to succeed or not, we need to see in time. But the youth who've grown up with that as a reality is very different than my generation. I grew up with Watergate. When that was the defining moment when I was a teenager, which was a very different sense. It was a sense of cynicism and lost dream. And I think what the digital generations growing up with is a sense of potential, of their own potential, because of technology. And because they have that sense of potential, they're going to create change based on it. So So you can see how technology influences us, and then we start influencing culture, and we start influencing technology. So I forget what your question was, but my sense is that we have a very different relationship to our world now, to the ability to create change, to the smallness of our world and the interconnectedness of the world. That something happening in Turkey is not that far from Philadelphia or Alaska, even though Philadelphia and Alaska are not going to be touched by the kind of violence that's going on in Turkey now.
Absolutely. Now, are there practices that you recommend for individuals who are compelled to follow this way of developing in their own life?
I definitely would recommend spiritual practice. If people are doing practice, I would encourage them to take their own practice more seriously and think more about why they're doing it. What are they trying to achieve or stabilize? What's it for? What's the context they're doing it in? And I would encourage people to meditate, to get access to that dimension of being that we spoke about at the beginning. I would encourage people to study the evolutionary spiritual teachers. I would encourage them to study, you know, classical religion, to really allow yourself to reflect, not just to study to accumulate knowledge, but to be touched by it, because there's so many great thinkers. And I would encourage people to come together in shared inquiry, because that process of coming together in the way we are now in focused inquiry, where you're really looking at questions that matter, the existential questions of life, and you're coming together to explore that and to listen deeply to each other, to learn from each other, and to help each other's depth come out. All of those are aspects of practice that I would very much encourage, because we're not going to just develop by chance. We do need to put some effort into it.
That was a question I was going to ask. You know, there's a way, I think, of relating to evolution that it's just a natural process that happens on its own. And there's even spiritual ideas that you don't need to intervene, you just need to be. So what you're describing is really a very kinetic, a very active, engaged, conscious involvement with the creative process, and that it happens in relationship with others. And so any comments on that?
And I want to add to what you said. It's not just, I think that what I see in our culture a lot is the idea that just having an experience will change you. So getting, you know, so everyone says, well, you should travel, you should go around the world, you should interact with different cultures. And so there's this thirst for having experiences as though that was actually going to change. But what you're saying is there are things that you actually need to do for self-cultivation to take those experiences and move them forward.
Right. And that's also an inner posture. When I used to go hiking in the Himalayas, and I went on to some beautiful places around. I think that the highest height I ever reached was 5,700 meters in Ladakh. And when I finished that trek, I was talking to somebody else, and they were telling me about somewhere else I could go. And there was a certain dawning that, as much as I love those vistas, just hitting one more vista, one more higher plateau, was not going to make any difference. And I realized that I could just go on and on and on and on in my life just seeking for the next mountain pass. And I had already, in some sense, done it. So it wasn't the accumulation of one more experience, but it was the relationship to the life that I was living and the context that I was living it in that was going to make all the difference.
So one thing that I wanted to follow up on that is there's something about seeing and responding. So it's an ever-deepening capacity to see into what we could say the infinite unfolding, and the capacity to perceive with ever more subtlety. And then there's the capacity to respond.
Right, and we need to develop both. We need to learn how to see. We need to learn how to sort through input information. You know, because people who are trained in the subtleties of human development will sit in a room or a conversation, and they'll respond to something infinitesimally small that somebody says that can unlock, you know, a beautiful insight that other people with less sensitivity wouldn't see. So we need to learn how to see. We need to learn how to sort through information and sort out depth and be able to discern different levels of depth in our own conversations, where someone's coming from, what's motivating them. And then also we need to respond. So if we have an insight, what are we doing with it? Is our life changing according to it? Are we pushing ourselves to take that, you know, newfound vista and translate it out? What are the new values in our marriage that we should be expressing now that we've discovered a sense of fulfillment that doesn't need another person to fulfill us? Are our intimate relationships changing? Are we changing in our motive in how we relate to our coworkers and how our company is organizing and what the goal of the business is? We can still make money and have ethics.
So in essence, you're talking about a responsibility that everyone has who's awake to this, to live up to what they've already seen, to actually try to, it's not the purpose is not to continue just having these experiences, but it's to really say, okay, what do I actually know based on the experiences I've had, and how do I live up to that? How do I bring that truth into the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like you shift your whatever you're orienting your life towards. So it's not how am I doing and how can I change in relationship to my insight. It's, oh, what does that higher insight mean about life? And then you walk the path that lays out before you. It's subtle, but it's a profound shift.
With evolution, I think there's probably a paradox there. On one hand, there is this ecstatic creativity, there's the spirit of innovation, the thrill of discovery, but there's also the requirement that we be able to bear a lot of friction, because that kind of deep seeing and excitement generates change, and change creates friction. And so how do people navigate through the both the thrill and the challenge of an evolutionary perspective?
Well, that's where spiritual community makes a lot of difference. We want to have friends who we share this with, and whether they're friends that we're together with physically or friends we connect with on a radio program, on a virtual class, or... Yeah, technology does allow us to connect with people who aren't in our geographical immediate surroundings, which helps a lot. And we want to have real comrades in arms of spirit. So that's why you can see that monks and nuns throughout the ages came together in these monasteries, because they wanted to support each other in the very challenging process of changing how we think, what we believe in, and how we live. So we need each other. We really do need each other. And that would be one huge set of support. And the other, I think, is related to something that Sam keeps asking, which is spiritual experience not being... We don't want to keep seeking for experience. We want to cultivate stability. We want to cultivate stability within the ups and downs. When we're having radical, profound spiritual experiences, we want to recognize them for what they are, learn from them, allow ourselves to be changed, but also stay stable, keep our feet on the ground in a certain way that doesn't limit what's possible and the kind of transformation that can come out of it, but also so we don't get attached or we don't get emotionally destabilized by all of that. So we want to cultivate our own self-discipline. And also we want to develop deep relationships with other people.
As you're bringing in the relationship component, I'm struck by the fact that the spiritual discovery is only ever about love. And love can be described and mean many things to people, depending upon the worldview and their life experience. What you're describing is really an incredible expression of love in the world, where this deep unifying truth finds its way into the structures of culture that lift us all up from the highest possible perspective in relationship with others. Can you say a little bit about the distinctions of love and how we grow through what we've learned as maybe a psychological worldview, and maybe love oftentimes can be an economic exchange in relationship to this higher love that you're describing?
Well, I guess one way to answer that is that I saw the movie Before Midnight last night with Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke, so that's why I was laughing. I was thinking about their midlife expressions of love, which is, it's an interesting study in postmodern relationships, and brilliantly acted. What does love have to do with the spiritual life, and what are the different ways we can think about love? I think partly love is something that we need to discover. We really need to inquire into it. We need to inquire what it is. Love can be an action. We can express love through our care for emergence, our care for higher potentials, our care for the well-being and development of everyone around us and of culture as a whole. That's love in action. Love can also be that realization that we spoke about earlier of fullness. And love can be that expression of joy. And then you see people like the great Indian saint, Amici, or Mata Amrita Nandamayi, and she is an extraordinary expression of love. She hugs people. That's part of what she does as her spiritual gift to people. She teaches some, but more it's through this expression. But her awakening is so unusual. She was a poor, illiterate child, and she has extraordinary service missions around the world. When the last tsunami hit Asia, she was able to donate $45 million in relief.
Wow. That's
incredible.
And she came... So love can take many expressions. And we want to not be afraid of that word, and we want to not be afraid of expressions of affection and intimacy between people. At the same time, we want to disembed ourselves from the kind of more materialistic and bartering systems of love that often define relationships. I'll love you if you do that, and that end up making us be filled with angst. So love, I feel, is something that one expresses more than what one receives.
That's great, Amy. We are in the last seconds of the show. Is there anything you can share with the listeners to follow up with your work?
You can go to my website at amyedelstein.com. I teach virtually. I also teach in person. I also do some individualized work. So you can find out more about it at amyedelstein.com. And I would just want to encourage everyone to take your own spiritual stirring seriously. And it doesn't matter how small the glimpse is. We always want to undervalue our own search and think that we should have started 25 years ago and we missed the wave. And I would just want to encourage everyone to continue to seek and to continue to develop and to give everything to that.
That's beautiful. Thank you very much,
Amy
Edelstein. Thanks for being on our show.
Have a great evening, everyone. Take care.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.